This is Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue on KGMI News Talk 790, 96.5 FM in Bellingham. Streaming live at mybellinghamnow.com.
Welcome to Wealth Wake Up Live. Dick Donahue with you this Saturday morning. As always, we thank you to be with us. Going to start out with our weekly wrap for this week. And we saw the stock market log another downbeat week. The Russell 2000 fell 2.8%. The S&P 500 declined 3.1%. And the NASDAQ Composite registered a 5.5% loss. The price-weighted Dow Jones Industrial Average settled unchanged on the week. The Friday's action, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ Composite saw their sixth consecutive loss. Ongoing weakness in mega-cap stocks and semiconductor shares, which have led the market higher so far this year. The mega-cap growth ETF dropped 5.8% this week. The PHLX semiconductor index sank 9.2%. ASML and TSMC were standout losers in the SOX, declining 10.6% and 10.4% respectively. This week, after reporting quarterly results, the ASML reported weaker than expected first quarter bookings. TSMC reported better than expected earnings, but warned that the chip industry is enduring a more gradual recovery than expected. Nvidia was another top laggard from the space, dropping 13.6% with no specific news. News from shares of Nvidia were still 53.9% higher than the start of 2024. Some of the sessions this week featured buy the dip action at the open that faded as the session progressed. The lack of strong conviction from buyers became its own downside catalyst. Many stocks settled lower this week. The equal-weighted S&P 500 logged a 1.3% decline. The downside bias in stocks was also related to rising interest rates, with Fed officials suggesting that they're in no hurry to cut rates because of recent inflation reports have not given them enough confidence that inflation is on a sustainable path to its 2% target. The two-year note yield settled 9 basis points higher, that'd be 0.9% at 4.97%, and the 10-year note yield settled 12 basis points higher at 4.62%. Geopolitical uncertainty related to the events in the Middle East also contributed to the negative bias this week in equities. Israel attacked the Iranian territory, though like Iran's attack over last weekend, Israel's response did not produce significant damage. Many stocks participated in this week's retreat. 8 of the 11 S&P 500 sectors declined. The information technology was down 7.3%. The consumer discretionary down 4.5%. And consumer communication services down 3.2%. They logged some of the largest declines. They chipped in weakness from mega cap constituents. The rate-sensitive real estate sector was also a top laggard, falling 3.6%. Consumer staples were up 1.4%, utilities up 1.9%, and financials up 0.8%, were the sectors and they logged some gains for the week. Taking a look at the week daily action, we saw that on Monday, the stock market started the week on an upbeat note. The major indices were all trading higher, thanks to some buy on the dip action following recent declines, which was helped by a sense of relief that Iran's attack on Israel didn't result in any economic damage. Initial buyer enthusiasm started to fade, however. Shortly after the market opened, there was no significant news catalyst coinciding with the early deterioration that was likely driven by continued consolidation efforts. Selling picked up steam, though, in the afternoon trade following reports that Israel's chief of staff said that there will be a response to Iran's attack on Israel. The major indices ultimately settled for at or near their worst levels of the session. The outsized impact of weakness in mega-cap stocks and chip makers also contributed to the index's level deterioration. Reviewing Monday's economic data, we saw March retail sales were up 0.7%. Prior revised up 0.9% from 0.6%. March retail sales, if you exclude autos, were up 1.1%. Prior was revised to 0.6% from 0.3%. So both of them increased substantially. The key takeaway from this report is that the U.S. consumer, fortified by strong job markets, continued to expand freely in March, and in an act that will continue to support the soft landing or no landing outlook for the U.S. economy. April's New York Fed Empire State Manufacturing Index was down 14.3. Prior was down 20.9. February's business inventories were up 0.4%. Prior, they were flat. And April's NHB Housing Index was at 51. That was unchanged for the month. On Tuesday, stocks had a volatile session. The S&P 500 settled 0.2% lower. The NASDAQ composite logged a 0.1% decline. And the price-weighted Dow Jones Industrial Average eked out a 0.2% gain thanks to strength in its heaviest component, which is United Healthcare, after reported earnings. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ composite traded close to their prior closing levels in the early going, showing relatively modest gains and losses. Choppiness increased, however, in the afternoon trade as participants reacted to a commentary from Fed Chair Powell. A jump in market rates contributed to an underlying negative bias in the market through most of the session. So, reviewing Tuesday's economic data, March's housing starts were 1.321 million. Prior was revised to 1.549 million from 1.521 million. March's building permits at 1.458 million. Prior was revised to 1.523 from 1.518. The key takeaway from these reports is that they provided no signs of relief for a supply-constrained housing market. Single unit starts were down by double-digit percentages in every region except the West, which was up 1.3%. Meanwhile, building permits, which is a leading indicator for single-family units, were down in every region, highlighted by a 5.3% decline in the South, which is the country's largest housing market. March's industrial production was up 0.4%. Prior was revised to up 4% also from up 0.1%. So March's capacity utilization was at 78.4. Prior was revised to 78.2 from 78.3. The key takeaway from these reports is that industrial production remained on a growth track in March, driven by gains in manufacturing output that one would expect to see in a growing economy. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up Live here on KGMI. We'll be back shortly. Thank you for listening.
Sustainable gardening, planting it right the first time so that your garden thrives now and in the future. It requires knowing your territory and gardening zones. Are you in the Sudden Valley shade, dodging deer in Geneva, facing nor'easters in the county, or getting salt spray from Birch Bay? Struggling to navigate the unique challenges of your growing zone? The staff at Kent's Garden and Nursery knows what to plant and where, with everything you need to make your own sustainable garden flourish, no matter what neighborhood you live in. And they can help with their custom plant design service. You'll learn to create the garden of your dreams, offering sustainable solutions so you plant it right the first time, whether you're a seasoned gardener or just starting out. Come out to Kent's with 5.5 acres of plants to inspire you. Talk to the experts at Kent's. They'll know how to put your garden on the right path for both you and future generations to enjoy. Kent's Garden and Nursery, the largest nursery in town, on Northwest in Bellingham and online at kentsgardenandnursery.com.
When you buy a Subaru from Dewey Griffin, you're buying more than a vehicle. You're buying safety for your family and reliability. Simply put, you're buying trust. Check out the huge inventory of new and pre-owned Subarus online today at DeweyGriffinSubaru.com. From the 8-passenger Ascent to the Forester Impreza and the all-new Crosstrek. Plus, get up to 1.9% APR financing on select new 2024 Subaru Outbacks. Dewey Griffin, community-minded, community-driven, and the only Subaru-certified tire and service center in Whatcom County.
We don't have the usual traffic jams that they have in the big city.
but sometimes things happen to snarl everything up. Depend on KGMI to keep you cruising to your destination with KGMI traffic alerts. We'll tell you where the trouble spots are. And if you see problems on the road, give us a call at 360-676-5464 so we can spread the word. KGMI News Talk 790, 96.5 FM, and KGMI.com.
The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KGMI or the Cascade Radio Group.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life. And I had to start again with just my children and my wife.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up Live. Dick Donahue with you this Saturday morning. As always, we thank you for being with us. If you want to get a hold of us, we are Asset Advisors. We are located out on the Pacific Highway in the Pacific Commerce Center next to Wilson's Furniture. Our address is 5060 Pacific Highway, Suite 101, Ferndale, 98248. Our phone number, 360-733-1200. And check out our website at wealthwakeup.com. Okay, continuing on with this week's market summary for the week, we found that on Wednesday, the trade featured mostly negative action on below average volume at the New York Stock Exchange. Some early buying efforts were driven by a buy the dip mentality that faded quickly with no specific news catalyst to account for the activity. There was another attempt to move higher in the afternoon trade, which ran into some resistance, but still led the major indices to close off of their lows. The overall downside vibe felt through the session was due to weakness in the mega cap stocks and the semiconductors names. ASML was the worst performer in the stocks after reporting weaker than expected first quarter earnings. Some negative response to earnings news since Tuesday's close also contributed to the negative bias. Dow Components Travelers was a standout loser in that respect. J.P. Hunt Transport was logged a big loss after disappointing quarterly results. But United Airlines, meanwhile, was up big after pleasing quarterly results. So reviewing Wednesday's data, we saw the weekly mortgage MBA mortgage applications index at 3.3%. That was up 3.3. A week ago, it was up a tenth of 1%. Weekly crude oil inventories increased by 2.74 million barrels after increasing by 5.84 million barrels a week ago. On Thursday's session, we felt similar to the other sessions this week on below average volume at the New York Stock Exchange. That is to say that early gains faded due in part to a lack of conviction from buyers. There wasn't a lot of conviction from sellers either on Thursday's trade. Decliners had a fractional lead over advancers at both the New York Stock Exchange and at the NASDAQ. The price action left the S&P 500 down 0.2%. NASDAQ Composite was down a half. Russell 2000 was down a tenth. And that was the fifth consecutive loss. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, however, eked out a slight 0.1% gain. Weakness in some heavily weighted components like Microsoft, Amazon, and Tesla were hit, which hit a new 52-week low, had a disproportionate influence on index performance. Semiconductor shares also had a weak showing. So reviewing Thursday's economic data, we saw initial weekly jobless claims come in at 212,000. That was revised from 200 to the week before from 212 to 211, basically unchanged. Weekly continuing claims at 1.812 million. Prior was revised to 1.10 million. That's from 1.17. So the key takeaway from this report remains that the low initial jobs claims number, which is a leading indicator, which continues to be indicative a solid labor market that portends good growth dynamics for the economy. April's Philadelphia Fed Index came in at 15.5, prior was 3.2, so substantial increase there. March's existing home sales at 4.19 million, prior was at 4.38 million. The key takeaway from this report is that sales activity was weak at the start of the spring selling season as high prices, high mortgage rates, and low inventory got in the way of more robust selling activity. March's leading activities, leading indicators, were down 0.3%. Priors were revised to up 0.2% from 0.1%. And Friday's S&P 500 dropped 0.9%. It closed below the 5,000 level for the first time since February. And the NASDAQ composite was down 2.1%, logged decent losses due to ongoing weakness in mega cap stocks. Meanwhile, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 0.6%. The Russell 2000 was up 0.2%. They settled the final session of the week with gains. Market breadth was also reflected. Buying activity under the index surface, despite new developments in the Middle East. The negative price action in the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ composite were largely driven by ongoing weakness in mega cap stocks. The mega cap ETF declined 2.4%. Shares of Nvidia tumbled 10% and no news, bringing the stock below its 50-day moving average of $841.99. And Nvidia is still up 53.9% since the start of the year. Meanwhile, the equal weight S&P 500 rose 0.4%, and four of the S&P 500 sectors gained at least 1%. Strength in bank stocks and ongoing earnings news from sector helped drive a 1.4% gain in the financial sectors. We saw the Dow component, American Express, also contributed to the outperformance of the S&P 500 financial sector. Fellow Dow component Procter & Gamble was also closed higher after reporting earnings. There was no economic data of note on Friday. So year-to-date up through yesterday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which changed unchanged for the week, is now up 0.8%. Your NASDAQ index was down 5.5% this week, but is still up 1.8% for the year. The S&P 500 index, which was down 3% this week, is still up 4.1% for the year. And the Russell 2000 index, which is down 2.8% this week, was now down 3.9% for the year. Well, let's take a look at our focus of the week. And we're going to look today at what the Personal Consumption Expenditures, or PCE Index, which became the Federal Reserve's preferred inflation gauge in 2000. This shift occurred when Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan highlighted its advantages in the monetary policy report to Congress. The Fed favors the PCE index over the consumer price index for several reasons. Firstly, the PCE index uses a formula that adapts to changes in spending habits, reducing the upward bias that's inherent in the consumer price index's fixed weight approach. It also employs weights based on broader expenditure measures. Additionally, the PCE index historical data can be revised to incorporate new information and improvements in measurement techniques, which include refinements to the source data used in CPI, leading to a more consistent time series. And the Federal Open Market Committee, or FOMC, has adopted the PCE as its preferred measure. It continues to use a range of price metrics and other cost information in order to assess inflation trends. So for further clarity, let's start out talking a little bit about the PCE price index breakdown. The PCE price index has been divided into two main categories, goods and services. Goods represent 33.1% of the index, while durable goods, which is items intended to last 3 years or more, such as appliances, furniture, and non-durable goods with a shorter lifespan like food and clothing, contributing 11.6% and 21.4% of the overall index, respectively. That's about 0.1% rounding there. But services account for 66.9% of the index. That's dominated by household consumption expenditures, which hold a substantial 64% weighting. Nonprofits contribute a smaller portion at 2.9%. And with household consumption expenditures, housing and utilities from the largest group, influencing the index with 17.7% weighting, and there's followed closely by healthcare at 16.3%. Then let's take a look at the PCE versus CPI. Since 2000, the annualized gain in the PCE price index has typically been about 0.4% lower than the consumer price index due to several key differences. First, the CPI uses fixed basket of goods and services with quantities based on past consumption, rarely updating. In contrast, the PCE index adapts more dynamically, reflecting changes in consumer behavior and substitutions in response to price changes by frequently adjusting their weights based on current spending data. Second, consumption categories in CPI and PCE are weighted differently. For instance, housing accounts for about 45% of CPI, but only 15.4% of the PCE. And the CPI measures direct out-of-pocket expenses by consumers. Well, the PCE includes all goods and services consumed by households, even those paid by employers in the government, like medical premium payments made by employers, providing a broader view of a consumption. Lastly, variations in seasonal adjustments and price calculations for identical products also cause discrepancies. For example, the PCE's airline fare index is based on passenger revenue and miles traveled, whereas CPI measures ticket prices for specific routes, leading to different pricing insights. Then let's talk about super core inflation. For decades, economists have excluded food and energy prices from inflation measures, commonly referred to as core prices, because they can both be seasonal and volatile. Starting in November of 22, the Federal Reserve said it will focus on a narrow measure known as super core inflation, which refines this perspective even further. Fed economists categorize core inflation into three segments: core goods, housing services, and core services minus housing. The latter category, often referred to as supercore, gained traction after the COVID lockdowns. This focus stems from the Fed's belief that service sector prices, while goods prices are predominantly influenced by labor costs, a factor the Fed thinks it can influence. Typically costs cools economic activity and jobs growth, with fewer rate cuts this year than the market had been expecting. A little long on this segment. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening.
You know why DeWard and Bodie has been around in this community for more than 78 years? Simple. They're dedicated to their customers, like you and like me. They're Whatcom's Gadget and Island County's trusted appliance experts. And the difference at DeWard and Bodie is they have in-house trained professionals who deliver and install your appliances. Plus, they service what they sell. That means when you need help, you call their phone and talk to real pros who will come to your home to service and repair your appliances. You can shop in confidence at DeWard and Bodie, knowing you'll always be taken care of. They stock the best selection of appliance mattresses at the best prices, and even offer no money down, no interest financing options. Oh, they've got some great offers going on right now. Like, you can save up to $100 on their professional delivery and installation when you buy select dishwashers and cooking appliances, or get cash back rebates up to $400 on select LG and KitchenAid appliance packages. Experience the DeWard and Bodie difference at their locations in Bellingham and Burlington.
I'm still going for it, even with higher stroke risk from atrial fibrillation and a regular heartbeat not caused by a heart valve problem. Over a 3-year study, Eliquis apixaban tablets reduced stroke risk better than warfarin, and over 97% of Eliquis patients did not experience a stroke. A first stroke occurred in 2.9% of warfarin patients versus 2.3% of Eliquis patients.
Don't stop taking prescription Eliquis without asking your doctor. It may increase your stroke risk. Eliquis can cause serious and, in rare cases, fatal bleeding. Don't take Eliquis if you have an artificial heart valve, abnormal bleeding, or antiphospholipid syndrome. While taking, you may bruise more easily or take longer for bleeding to stop. stop. A spinal injection while on Eliquis increases risk of blood clots, which may cause paralysis, the inability to move. Get medical help right away for unexpected bleeding, unusual bruising, or tingling, numbness, or muscle weakness. Medications such as aspirin products, NSAIDs, SSRIs, SNRIs, and blood thinners may increase bleeding risk. Tell your doctor about all planned medical or dental procedures. Learn more at Eliquis.com or call 1-855-ELIQUIS.
KGMI connects with Joe Tien.
I grow a lot of vegetables, and I've tried numerous ways to control aphids. The only thing that I've found that works is a systemic treatment.
Okay.
And every fiber of that plant is treated.
Join us each weekday at 4 p.m. for KGMI Connects.
I don't think that racism is in every fiber of our society.
On KGMI News Talk 790, 96.5 FM, and MyBellinghamNow.com. The latest local news and important topics of the day from the West Mechanical Studio.
Rest easy in a cool home this summer. Contact West Mechanical Heating, Air Conditioning, and Electrical to add AC to your existing system for as little as $140 a month. Find them at westmechanical.net.
Get the latest news and information 24/7 with KGMI News Talk 790, 96.5 FM in Bellingham. Streaming live at MyBellinghamNow.com.
CBS News Brief. Opening arguments in the hush money trial of former President Trump begin Monday. Meanwhile, a man who set himself on fire outside the Manhattan courthouse has died. Fred Gates saw the whole thing.
Before he doused himself, he threw a bunch of flyers into the air. He went into the backpack and flew them all with a flourish, like way up.
The man has been identified as Max Azzarello of St. Augustine, Florida. House Speaker Mike Johnson's job may be on the line. Here's CBS's Scott McFarland.
A third hardline Republican, Arizona's Paul Gosar, has signed on to a plan that could oust his fellow Republican Mike Johnson as U.S. House Speaker. The group has criticized Johnson for pushing a major proposal largely supported by Democrats.
That major proposal includes foreign aid to Ukraine. Employees at a Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga have voted to join the United Auto Workers Union. This man was among them.
The people that do the job, build the cars, our voices need to be heard. We need to be treated fairly.
CBS News Brief. I'm Linda Kenyon.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up Live. Donahue with you this Saturday morning. As always, we thank you for being with us. Well, you know, I've been talking about the ups and downs of the market a little bit here, but let's talk a little bit about why do stocks fall? And since 1964, what's that, 60 years ago? Yep, 60 years ago, there have been 27 S&P 500 index corrections of 10% or greater. And during this time, data from Piper Sandler observed that each market correction had at least one or three main catalysts. Higher interest rates were one of them, rising unemployment was one of them, or a global shock. And are we due for a market correction that could make history tell us about the next one? Well, let's talk about this a little bit. The majority of stock market corrections have historically been triggered by rising interest rates, averaging 16% decline. Rising unemployment, though less frequent, often coincides with economic recessions and more severe corrections, with an average decline of 36%. Shocks, or those that were the events that are outside of the U.S. economy, such as the Asian financial crisis and the Euro debt crisis, are the rarest cause, but they still have led to significant corrections, averaging almost 19%. During the 70s and 80s, higher interest rates contributed to all market downturns, although this did lead to higher unemployment. However, this pattern of higher interest rates shifted in the 90s and 2000s due to a structural decline in rates and the adoption of zero interest rate policies after the global financial crisis, making rate hikes less of a catalyst for market corrections. However, in the past pandemic era, rising interest rates have become considerable risk for equity markets. And while the leading indicators or candidates for the next correction could be a continuation of higher than anticipated inflation or escalating conflicts in the Middle East, we believe that the Federal Reserve remains on track to ease monetary policy. And of course, we hope that the current geopolitical conflicts do not spread. Should interest rates begin to decline, we believe this micro environment may help small cap growth stocks' relative performance, particularly given their lower evaluations on price to earnings basis and faster estimated earnings growth than large caps over the next few years. So something to think about if we have this little correction that we're kind of going through right now. Okay, well, we're seeing that economists are boosting their U.S. GDP forecasts, and they see higher Fed rates for longer. They once again have updated their forecast for U.S. growth, spending, and employment, but they also see interest rates remaining higher for longer as above target inflation persists. The upper boundary for the Federal Reserve's target range for its benchmark interest rates, currently at 5.5%, they said will fall only by 4% by the end of to fall to 4% by the end of 25, according to the latest Bloomberg monthly survey. That's a half percentage point higher than the respondents had expected just a month ago. The median projection shows that 2/4 point cuts this year. So we've gone from 6 or 7 cuts this year down to possibly 2, according to the survey of economists. They also reduced the probability of a recession in the next 12 months to 30%. That's the smallest odds since June of 22, and it's down from 35% last month. Respondents now see gross domestic product expanding at 2.4% on average in 2024. That's up from 2.2% this last month's survey. The upgrade is driven not only by an uptick in consumer spending, but also stronger private investment, which forecasters see rising 2.9% this year. That compares to the 2.4% March forecast and is well above the year-ago projection of less than 1%. The 71 respondents in the Bloomberg survey conducted April 12th to 17th predicted that the labor market would remain solid, defying earlier expectations that the Fed's aggressive rate hikes in 22 and 23 would raise joblessness. Economists now see unemployment currently at 3.8%, will average less than 4% this year, and will not exceed 4.1% through the third quarter of 25. The upgrades for growth and hiring were accompanied by modestly higher forecasts for inflation, as measured by the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, which we talked about just a few minutes ago, the Fed's preferred measure. They now see overall PCE and core prices measures ending 2024 up 2.4% and up 2.5% respectively, close to where they are today. The Fed officials have made clear that they need more convincing evidence that inflation will continue to fall towards their 2% target before they are ready to cut rates. So basically, what went wrong with U.S. inflation? You know, there was supposed to be a year that the U.S. inflation rode the last mile down to 2%, letting the Federal Reserve to steadily reduce interest rates from two-decade high. Now those expectations have been dashed. Price gains have proven much stickier than anticipated a few months ago into 2024. A resilient economy and labor market on Tuesday, Federal Reserve Chair Powell said persistent inflation means borrowing costs will stay elevated for longer than previously thought, a shift in tone with ramifications for policy around the world. The persistent shortage of housing is partly to blame, as we're rising commodity prices and car insurance premiums, but some also point to Powell himself for prematurely telegraphing interest rate cuts, which ignited optimism in financial markets and fueled economic activity. Traders now see just 1 or 2 cut rate cuts this year from the current level of 5.25 to 5.5. That's a far cry from the 6 or 7 that were expected at the start of this year, and 3 that the Fed officials penciled in just a month ago. Investors and economists are flagging the chance of no cuts at all this year. We also saw Fed officials maintain that inflation is still broadly on a downward trend, but to also stress that borrowing costs won't be moving lower until they're more confident in that trajectory. And while much of the inflation damage has been evident in the Consumer Price Index, which accelerated to 2.5% in March from a year earlier, the Fed's preferred metric is the personal PCE expenditures index, and the PCE has been running closer to the central bank's 2% target, registering 2.5% in February. But progress on that gauge is also stalled. So here are some reasons for this latest wave in inflation. Number one, shelter and insurance. Shelter, which accounts for about a third of the CPI, also proved the most stubborn. Despite some timelier measures from Bureau of Labor Statistics, Zillow Group, Inc., and apartment lists show rent growth for the new lease is coming down, the corresponding components of the CPI have yet to reflect that. Part of the delay is because most tenants don't move in a given year. That's especially true that now that homeowners, as well as many of whom locked in cheap mortgage rates during the pandemic, do not want to get out a new loan at 7% or more. We're also seeing that U.S. tenant rents point to more distribution ahead. The owner equivalent rent component of the U.S. Consumer Price Index has been slow to accelerate. Also, construction of the index plays a role. Units are sampled only every 6 months, which means it takes a while for these rent changes to reflect. The PCE, meanwhile, assigns shelter a much lower weight, which helps explain why it's tended lower than the CPI. Another driver of inflation is insurance costs. Tenants and household insurance is rising at the fastest rate in 9 years, while auto insurance skyrocketed 22.2% this year through March, the most since 1976, a key reason cars are more technologically complicated now, and therefore they cost more to repair. We're also seeing that commodities, after falling for much of last year, energy prices, specifically oil, climbed in the first quarter, and an escalation in the war in the Middle East threatens to push them higher. The rally has translated into more expensive gasoline. Electricity prices have also climbed. Central bankers prefer to look at so-called core measure of inflation, which strips out food and energy that can be volatile. They also eyed a narrower gauge known as supercore, referring to services costs, excluding energy and housing, and even that's been too strong to do a robust labor market. But the surge, the price in oil and other raw materials is impossible to ignore, as it can filter through the cost of their shipping and merchandise areas. Gasoline and shelter combined accounted for over half of the monthly advance in the March Consumer Price Index. We have also seen a pivot by Chairman Powell. In December, he spurred big market bets on rate cuts by saying that such moves were clearly a topic of discussion. The comments effect was equal to lowering interest rates by 0.14%, and will also add about a half percentage point to the CPI this year, according to Anne Wong, who's chief U.S. economist at Bloomberg Economics. She said now Powell is entertaining the possibility that disinflation is indeed stalled and that the bar for cutting rates may have increased. This raises the risk that there may be a rate cut. This may not be a rate cut this year if unemployment rate is little changed from today. So we're continuing to see a very, very moving around economic situation. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up Live. We'll be right back.
Barclay Village and Lydia Place are teaming up to bring you the 2024 Barclay Village Wine Walk, Thursday, May 16th from 5 to 8 p.m. Stroll through Barclay Village, enjoying pop-up tasting rooms in 14 different shops and restaurants. Your $40 ticket buys you a keepsake wine glass, 8 wine tasting tickets, a goodie bag, and Hagen Snack Shack treats. 100% of the proceeds benefit Lydia Place's mission to end homelessness in our community. Tickets are available now. Sellout risk is high. Get yours online at Barclay Village Wine Walk.
KGMI wants to put a grand in your hand. You could be one word away from a chance to win $1,000.
That's right. Just listen each weekday to KGMI for the keyword during the 8 a.m., 11 a.m., 2 p.m., and 5 p.m. hours.
Then go to the Grand in Your Hand contest page at mybellinghamnow.com before midnight and enter each keyword for your chance to win $1,000.
We'll have four keywords each weekday so you can increase your chances of winning by entering all four every day we play the contest.
You already listen to KGMI for the latest local news and discussion of the latest issues. Now you can win $1,000 while you do it.
A Grand in Your Hand is brought to you on KGMI by Niederhouse of Luxury, Whatcom County's newest fine jewelry store, next to Lombardi's on Bellwether Way.
A Grand in Your Hand is back on KGMI.
Get details at mybellinghamnow.com.
Hey, so what's a great way to spread awareness that driving high is illegal everywhere? A catchy song, of course.
You can run, but you can't drive high. You can run, but you can't drive high.
Friendly reminder, don't drive high. If you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
'Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up Live. Dick Donahue with you this Saturday morning. As always, if you got questions for me, give me a call, 360-733-1200. Got a notice this week that came out on late Tuesday afternoon that I need to share with you. This applies to those that have to take required minimum distributions from their IRA beneficiaries that are subject to what we call the 10-year rule. And basically that they sent a notice called 24-35, which provides relief for 2024 for missed required minimum distributions for IRA beneficiaries that are subject to the RMDs within that 10-year payout period. So let's talk a little bit more detail here. This new relief builds on previous IRS relief for 21 and 22 annual RMDs in Notice 2253 and for 23 RMDs that came out in Notice 2354. Notice 2435, which is the new one, adds another year of relief for excusing 2024 missed RMDs for non-eligible designated beneficiaries of IRA owners who died in 2021 and 22 after the required beginning date. So what we're saying here is, if you're the beneficiary of an IRA, you're subject to this 10-year rule, and the owner of the IRA that you inherited died in 2021, 22, after those dates, and had already started making their required minimum distributions. This basically relieves missed 24 RMDs for those non-eligible designated beneficiaries. Those would typically be non-spouses and some other couple of exclusions in there. But basically, it says that you do not have to take out this RMD this year in 2024. It also relieves missed 2024 RMDs for those non-eligible beneficiaries for those who died last year in 2023 after the required beginning date. But it's important to note that this notice does not affect lifetime RMDs. Those are RMDs from inherited IRAs by eligible designated beneficiaries and there are who inherited before 2020. So if the person died before 2020, you still have to take out your RMD. However, it's over a lifetime rather than the 10-year period. So in this case, it only applies to those beneficiaries with annual RMDs within that 10-year window. So from a planning standpoint, this is the fourth year in a row which the IRS has waived their annual RMDs for beneficiary subject to that 10-year rule. So even though 21 and 24 RMDs are not required, you may still want to voluntarily withdraw your IRAs because while tax rates are low. So what we're saying there, that unless Congress acts, rates are going to go up in 2026. So putting off distributions could also mean that you're going to face a higher tax bill at the end of this 10-year period of time. So a couple of thoughts there. Number one, yes, income tax rates are expected to go up in 2026. So if you take money out now, even though you don't have to, it's probably going to be at a lower rate than it'll be a couple years from now. The second consideration, as I made, is there in this discussion, and we've done a couple of reports on this, but we found that if a client just does the takes away the minimum every year that they need to take out over that 10 years, they're still going to have almost roughly equivalent account balance to what they started with at the end of 10 years, which means they have to take that lump sum out all at one time 10 years from now. So depending on your age and your situation, something to think about is you may not want to delay taking those RMDs. So in Notice 2435, the IRS also says that it expects to finalize the proposed SECURE Act regulations issued in February of 22 so that they can be effective starting next year in 2025. This means that it's possible that these final regulations will be issued later this year. Of course, they were going to issue those, so they were going to be effective in 2024 also. We'll keep an eye on that and keep you informed. If you got questions about that one, you can always give me a call, 360-733-1200. Okay, the great wealth transfer. Well, we're kind of talking about that with these IRAs. Is it a delusion? Well, it might sound like a heist film or a game show, but it's neither. It's also a rather morbid shorthand for the massive amount of money that boomers are expected to leave to their millennial kids, those making those adult children the richest generation in history, according to some headlines. This, we're told, will help solve the student debt crisis, allow cash strapped 30 and 40-year-olds to buy a house, even help them make up for lost time on saving for retirement. But thanks for the parting gift, Mom and Dad, but basically we're not buying it. The typical boomer is not in a position to leave any money at all. Historically, about 3 out of 4 parents have intended to leave something for their kids. But according to data from the Federal Reserve, only about 1 out of 4 kids actually receive an inheritance. And the odds are even lower if you're not white. Generous intentions run into hard math. True, as a group, boomers are holding on to a huge sum, maybe as much as $90 trillion, or half the wealth of the country. So perhaps the time will be different, but we're beginning to doubt it. One thing distorting the averages, there's an awful lot of baby boomers. There's a clue in that name. They account for about 20% of the population, with people over 65 making up a bigger share of the U.S. than at any point since the government began keeping track a century ago. The impressive-sounding averages are also distorted by massive wealth at the top. According to Economic Policy Institute analysis of the Federal Survey of Consumer Finances back in 2016, the average late-career couple had saved about $243,000 for retirement. Not shabby, but the median number tells a different story, just $21,000. So let's, tales of the boomer wealth have also been inflated by rising home prices, again, particularly for those in the top 10%, but home prices aren't the same as home equity. Many boomers have significant debt in their homes. Some are still paying off their original mortgage. Others have borrowed against their homes to put cash in their pockets, either with a reverse mortgage, home equity loan, or cash out refinance. And they're going to leave less money to pass on to their heirs. So that little suggested amount of money that they keep talking about may not be there. Okay, so most Americans that retire within 5 years also retire within 5 years earlier than expected, meaning the recent Transamerica survey due to layoffs, health problems, or the need for care for an ailing partner or elderly parent, that left them with less time to accumulate. And another nasty reality, healthcare costs are much higher for people over 65 than for younger people. The majority of one's healthcare expenditures happens after retirement. Medicare doesn't cover dental or vision care because the U.S. healthcare system teeth and eyes are a bit like checked luggage on a flight meal or a flight meal, it's an optional upgrade for those who choose to splurge. Only about half the people over age 65 have saved any money for their home health aid, about $60,000 a year, nursing home care over $100,000 a year. Neither are covered by Medicare, and Medicaid only kicks in after all your savings have run out. So be sure the richest boomers will have plenty to leave to their heirs. But it's unclear how much of the difference that is going to make. Those millennials probably don't have college loans, already have parental help to buy a house, and maybe even grandma paying for child care and tuition. For them, that great wealth transfer is already underway, and it has been for some time. So given the increase in life expectancy of the richest Americans, the big money isn't likely to change hands until millennials are close to retirement themselves. They can't live their whole life working as if late windfall is a sure thing. It's just too risky. So all these factors taken together should be enough to put the kibosh on dreams of a society transforming intergenerational wealth transfer. This has been Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up Live here on KGMI this Saturday morning. Thanks for listening. Don't forget our show tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And if you have questions for me, give me a call, 360-733-1200. Thanks and have a great week.
Voiced on the show are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a decision.